All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All of our business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. For some of you, I understand it might be your first time before the court, so welcome here. I am the senior judge. I have difficulty saying that all the time because it's a relatively new position to be in, but it's accurate, so I can't contest it. To my right is Judge Peach, and to my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here today in the matter of Garcia versus Shulkin, 153669. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Chief Judge, I'm Bill Lesperance from Albuquerque, New Mexico, for the appellant.
Thank you, Mr. Lesperance, is that correct?
Yes.
And this is your first time before the court?
It is.
Well, welcome here.
Thank you.
Your Honor, Omar Youssef with the Secretary, and with me as co-chair is Ken Walsh.
Gentlemen, thank you, and I think you've both been here before. Welcome. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
I have, Your Honor. I have reserved 7 minutes.
7 minutes? Okay. So noted. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, it is an honor and a privilege to be here. And I believe that Chief Judge Davis knows more about this case than I do. And this case has been in front of the court probably four times over the last 11 years. And so I don't think going through any of the facts is going to be very helpful. I will go back if we have a need, but I've probably forgotten more about this case than some of you know. But what I do have is a pretty firm belief that two things at this point are not right about this case. And one is that Chief Judge Davis has tried to get this case resolved on a couple of different occasions, and it seems to me that, in very simple terms, the directions that the court has given to the BVA have not been followed, and that the court has tried very, very hard to articulate a simple request to have the case re-adjudicated, and that the re-adjudication has not occurred. And it might be important to talk about what we mean by adjudication, but I think that seems to me to be the problem. And the last order that came up had a lot of language in it that was nonspecific and conjectural, a lot of could be, would be, should be, might be kind of language in it. And it never reached any kind of an evaluation that looked to me like a re-adjudication. And I don't know how it would look to you, but it seemed to me that the re-adjudication that the court requested or tried to have the Board of Veterans Appeals do would involve a total review of the record. I think Judge Greenberg, pointed something out in one of his cases about this sort of thing. And what that means, in my mind, was going back through the record, not citing every little darn thing, but at least hitting the major points and saying, this is what we did. But that isn't what happened. And what happened on both of the occasions that this case was written up after Chief Judge Davis sent his orders back sounded a lot the same. That nothing new had been done. And the couple of things that stand out to me on a factual level that show me that this wasn't done were that nowhere has the board ever looked or talked about the work that was done by the treating physicians at the VAMC in Albuquerque. The VAMC has some pretty good psychologists and psychiatrists. It always has, as long as I've known them. That has not been a problem. And the folks that were treating the veteran for something like 20 years, they were never mentioned in any of the board's opinions, even though I've asked for that to be done since at least 2011, but probably going back further than that. And the other thing that stood out to me was that it's pretty clear in the record from the various doctors' opinions that are in the record and the testimony at the one hearing that was held, is that this veteran did see somebody in the service, even though his records were burned and his records aren't here, his service medical records, he did see somebody in the service on at least two occasions, and I found some morning reports that indicate that there was something that went on, and that he was seen by somebody in the service on at least two occasions, and that wasn't brought out, I don't think, by the board in any of their comments. So with those two things being said, there may be some other things that would strike the court as important, but it seems to me that there wasn't a review of the record as a whole. And it would seem to me that since they had been asked about these things and told about these things, even the doctor in Albuquerque that issued that first comp and pen report in 2005, Dr. Green, she was pretty clear that he had been seen a couple of times by the psychiatric service when he was in, I think, North Carolina at the time. And the fact that that wasn't done or talked about by the board seems to me to be a lack of attending to important parts of the record as a whole. So that's the first thing. I don't think the adjudication's ever been actually done the way it was ordered by the court. The second thing is the constitutional issue that's been finally, I think, fairly well presented. And I think the last time we were before the court on paper, the court did not have the benefit of some of the efforts that have been made in that regard. In particular, there was a motion that was made in 2013, I believe, to motion to vacate, that that we tried to show the court that this activity that took place back in 2005 caused the comp and pen exam doctor in Albuquerque to change her opinion. And the reason why I think it's obvious that she changed her opinion is she didn't have any reasons or basis on the second go-round. When that second little blurb came out where she said, I can't tell, it was five lines with no reasons and basis at all. And that has formed the underlying rationale for everything the board has done ever since.
Counsel, I think that's a great reference point in the record at 471. Mm-hmm. I believe that was Dr. Green's assessment. Would you mind turning to that section and explaining your point there, please?
Yeah, I think that what she did, and I think it was February of 2005 when she did the comp and pen exam, a couple of things are pretty clear. She actually interviewed the veteran. She actually had the veteran. And she conducted a comp and pen evaluation with the veteran. I'm not sure, it's not really clear how much record she actually looked at the time, but she did have the veteran. And so what she's saying in that is that based on everything that she's observing and that she's seeing and whatever record she is reviewing, and it's about a 2 or 3 page opinion, that it's as likely as not that this is actually a service-connected issue, this mental health issue.
Mm-hmm. Prior to that point, however, there had been a report in February of 2005 that was favorable.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's the one I'm talking about. Okay. That was about a 2-3 page opinion, the same doctor that Dr. Green wrote. Mm-hmm. And in Albuquerque, and she did go through some analysis. There was actually reasons and basis in this thing. And she determined based on what she observed by actually talking to the veteran and having a comp and pen exam, that this was as likely as not a service-connected event. So it, in my mind, you know, just from the little bit of this that I've done, it goes back to, in my mind, to saying, what would have happened if we just stopped there? If we'd have just stopped there, it's probably 99% certain that that would have been the end of the case and we wouldn't be here and we would have never had the last three appeals. And I think the best brief that's ever been written is the one that the American Legion did. Right after that, not mine. I think they did a really good job.
Excuse me, sir. This case you brought under clear and unmistakable error, under Q.
Right.
And the first time you brought it under Q, you cited three reasons. Then you requested reconsideration, and you added another reason under Q. And so now then that went back, and then you added a fifth reason for Q. What can you tell me why, how long can you bring Q actions?
The Q relates to the 2006 Board of Pension. And the interesting thing that happened was the American Legion discovered that there was a change in the doctor's opinion between February and October of 2005, these two different opinions. What they didn't know and what I didn't know until there was a record brought up somewhere around 2010 or 11, and we had a copy of the record and we could see this in the record, was that there was this effort by the AMC to tell the doctor what she should be doing. And that was something that the American Legion did not have privy. They were not privy to that. They didn't have a copy of that.
Do you have the record cite for that, counsel?
Pardon?
Do you have the record cite for that?
I can cite to the American Legion opinion, I think. So I think it's around 460. I could be wrong about that. I'll try to get back to that. But there's an excellent American Legion brief hiding in here somewhere. And I think maybe I haven't said that right. I'll try and find it. But it's in the record. The American Legion did a wonderful job of briefing this thing. But they didn't have the benefit of that information about the Appeal Management Center's directive. They didn't have that. They don't have, nobody had DVMS at that time. There was no way for them to see that. So, and I'm sorry, I'm not stumbling over it. Oh, here it is. It's 425 to 431. That's the American Legion brief. It's really quite good, except for that one part. But we didn't know about that. We didn't know that was coming. And the three things that I talked about originally, Judge Peach, they had to do with factual levels of determination. And I was really upset about the fact that the fire, St. Louis fire, wasn't being taken into consideration at that time. That was something that was really bothering me a lot. And I'm not sure whoever authored the court when it authored that Cook opinion that Mr. Youssef's probably going to talk about is the decision on the claim has to do with the claim for benefit. It doesn't have to do with every little theory that gets you to that claim. And so, you know, under that case, it's really not a finality problem. I mean, it's been raised. I think the court's aware of that. But it's not a finality problem. It's a jurisdictional question. When we're talking about a constitutional issue, a due process violation, that's not a finality problem. It's a constitutional question.
So you're saying that a constitutional issue can be raised at any time?
I am. And I believe this court has the authority and power to do that.
Yeah. May I just come back for a moment? Where did you get the morning report? These are the unit morning reports.
I did.
Did you get that from the Defense Department, or did the VA have them?
Oh, no, the VA didn't get them to me. No, I got them from the Defense Department, basically.
And there's an indication in there of treatment on the morning report, the unit morning reports.
Yeah, on the unit morning report, it's hard to tell what it was. But
right.
Yeah, but there was something, yeah.
And was this presented below?
Yes.
So we have the uncontroverted testimony of the widow, the veteran, the morning reports,
right.
The original report of Dr. Green,
right.
Would that be enough to give you the remedy?
I think so.
Okay.
Let me just tie up a part of what I think you were arguing, counsel. Record at 427 from the American Legion's brief, if I'm not mistaken. Is the direction that was received to return for a rationale, for a finding.
Right.
And then...
I don't think, it seems to me the American Legion didn't have the full report. They just knew that something had taken place.
Right. Okay. I have really two overarching concerns, and I appreciated your comments at the inception regarding the history of this case. One is the Hilliard decision by this court and its requirements to only allow a Q issue to be raised once, and then the due process issue and whether or not there was previous knowledge regarding the due process issue back in 2006 or so, and whether or not that should have been raised at that time. And if so, following Hilliard, does that mean that argument has been waived?
I think I understand the court's point, but you know, in the procedural history of this particular case, and I realize this court has thousands of cases they have to deal with, and I have one case. But in the particular history of this case, the court has pointed out that the Q consists of the way that the board dealt with the widow's testimony. And so that part of the case, I think, has proceeded forward, and I have not tried to argue the original three points that I brought up, and everybody's pointed that out. Those are not part of the case, and I understand that. But I don't think there's anything to prevent us from talking about a due process issue. And I think we can raise that at any time, and you know the Fed Circuit would raise it at any time on their own. So we have a serious problem here where Chief Judge has pointed out pretty articulately in one of his orders, that the court's orders, that there's some argumentation that went on between the AMC and this little doctor. And it's pretty obvious from the way she phrased that October 2005 Compton-Penn report, which has no reasons or basis, that she made a change based on that directive. No question about that.
Let me ask you this. On the one hand, do you think Hilliard was correctly decided, or should it be overturned or modified? And secondly,
okay,
do we need to even address that issue in order to give you the relief you want?
You don't need to address the issue to give me the relief I want. My personal opinion is it should be modified, because I think Q is something that should be available if it's there for the veteran's benefit. That's the point of the legislation, to allow the veteran to have their issue heard.
Would that be indefinitely at any point, regardless of how many opportunities the veteran has to raise it?
I'm not sure. That's why I said modified. I have no idea what would benefit the court on that level.
Okay. All right.
Well, you finally got a good lawyer as a veteran. So on the first, second, or third time, you were... What percentage of our cases are people who are veterans who represent themselves, VSOs,
yeah,
perfectly fine,
right,
lawyers, then experienced lawyers, then very good lawyers, or lawyers who accidentally stumble on the correct approach? So why should there be any limit? I'm asking a hypothetical question. Why should there be any limit on bringing this statutory issue of clear and unmistakable error?
My inclination would be to agree with that, because in the history that I've seen over the last 28 years or however long we've been here, the
the matter of an issue can be raised almost any time, as long as it benefits the veteran. Now, I understand the difference in Q. That's not exactly the same thing, and it is statutory. But to the extent that it makes some sense to go back and look at what happened, you know, 10, 20 years ago in a particular decision, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I don't think it's going to change the court's time involvement that much. I mean, we always can go back and raise issues almost indefinitely as long as we can do it. The big difference, I suppose, in whether there's a back pay involved. You might have to have a different effective date. I don't know about that. But in this particular case, for this particular veteran and widow, it makes really good sense in the facts of this case to examine the Q the way it was redefined by the court in 2011, right before the veteran died. And it makes a lot of sense to reinvestigate what happened, because this was a terrible thing, that the AMC would actually litigate against the veteran. I don't understand that at all. And when I found out about it, when I saw it in the record, that's what caused me to raise the issue. I thought it was a terrible thing to do.
Counsel, I'm struggling with two cases. I've already talked about Hillier. The other, and perhaps that needs some clarification or modification from this panel. The other is the Cook against Principi case, the Federal Circuit opinion, that basically recognized that there are two statutory exceptions to the rule of finality under this legislative scheme. A motion for revision on the basis of Q and a request to reopen a previously disallowed claim on the basis of new material evidence. Mm-hmm. Due process is not part of that equation, right, under that case.
It is not.
What is your assessment there?
I have two different thoughts about that, and Mr. Youssef did raise that particular case, so I had a chance to look at it. And it seems to me, as I said before, that the decision, the underlying decision, has to do with the denial of a claim for benefits. And denial of a claim for benefits doesn't go to the idea of what the particular argument is. The particular argument that supports the claim under Andre versus Principi does not seem to me to require that the simple denial of a claim for benefits precludes continuing to raise that Q. Andre versus Principi, it's 301 Fed Third, 1354. And exhaustion, that finality concept, is not jurisdictional. They're not the same thing. So for purposes of the constitutional claim, it doesn't matter. It's apples and oranges. The constitutional claim is a jurisdictional issue. Good case for that would be Maggott v. West, M-A-G-G-I-T-T v. West. It's a 202, it's old. 202 Fed Third, 1370. It's not as old as I am, but it's old. And Wood versus Peak. Wood versus Peak with an E, 520 Fed Third, 1345. Those cases are talking about the jurisdictional aspect of this. And you, I think this court, pretty clearly under 38 CFR 2904A is going to have the ability to examine a constitutional issue. They know what they want.
You're not saying the CFR in terms of our jurisdiction.
Well, no.
The Secretary has nothing to do with our jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, yeah. But I'm sorry, that's the board. That's the board that has. The board could
even. But even more importantly, even older than those cases, what about Johnson and Robeson, Justice Brennan's opinion?
Robeson.
The court is always,
right,
whether it's Article 1 or Article 3, courts are always open to deal with constitutional issues.
I agree. That's the one I cited in the brief, the Robeson case.
So your position, it sounds like to me, is that the Hilliard and Cook can be easily distinguished under the facts here.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Counsel, you have about 30 seconds to conclude if you'd like.
I'm done.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Youssef?
Chief Jeff Davis. May it please the Court. The Secretary in his brief made two arguments, one with respect to the Q issue and one with respect to the due process argument. As to Q, the Court should affirm the Board's determination that there was no Q in the October 2006 decision because the Board properly found that Appellant's testimony was not outcome determinative. Appellant has not shown that the high standards of Q were met in this case. And on this note, the Secretary emphasizes that the veteran, through counsel, had an opportunity to file a direct appeal to that decision, but voluntarily withdrew that appeal to pursue the Q issue, therefore subjecting this case to the higher Q standards. Under these high standards, if it is not absolutely clear that a different result was in order, even if there was an error, then that decision must be affirmed. Such is the situation here. The Board found that the testimony with respect to the manifestation of paranoia within the presumptive period, which is the only Q issue on appeal, was not outcome determinative because there was contravening evidence of record that showed a lack of continuity and did not establish manifestation of paranoia within that presumptive period. That finding was not an abuse of discretion, as appellant must now show in the Q analysis. It is not absolutely clear that the testimony would have changed the outcome of the case, and accordingly, the Court should affirm that decision.
Counsel, are we talking about Mrs. Garcia's testimony?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
My apologies, yes.
Both people testified, so.
Yes, Your Honor. The Court remanded because the Board did not properly consider the appellant's testimony, Mrs. Garcia's testimony.
Okay.
As to due process, the Secretary makes two arguments. In the first instance, the Secretary submits that the Court does not have jurisdiction to hear the due process argument, and second, if the Court finds that it does have jurisdiction, that there is no due process violation in this case, as the appellant had opportunities to redress his concerns under Guillory and King, but effectively threw them away when the appeal was voluntarily withdrawn. As to the first point, the Court does not have jurisdiction because, as noted in the Secretary's brief, the issue was never properly presented to the Board. The Court found in October 2014 that it lacked jurisdiction to hear appellant's constitutional theories of Q because she had not previously presented it to the Board. Nothing has changed since then. She did not make an argument through counsel prior to the current Board decision, even though she did raise additional argument and evidence pertaining to the Q theory about her testimony. Allowing jurisdiction, as Chief Judge Davis noted, would require another exception to finality, but the Secretary submits that is not allowed. The Federal Circuit in Cook, in their en banc decision in Cook, explained that there are only two statutory means to vitiate finality, and those are through Q, which was not pled before the Board in this case, and new and material evidence, which is not relevant here.
Well, this is a matter of law. Why should we be bound by what was or wasn't presented to the Board? Isn't that why we're here?
Your Honor, because the Court...
What is a matter of law? The Q standard is a legal question, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why aren't we the ones that determine as a matter of statutory construction? As we have, some of us may disagree with those decisions, but the Court is clearly the agent of change or of rectitude when it comes to this?
Because, Your Honor, we would submit that the Federal Circuit in Cook, their decision in Cook has a binding effect on this Court when they precluded the potential of due process, which they addressed and explained that it was not warranted because the claimant potentially would have various means to address the issue through direct appeal or through remand or through Q, for that matter. If the Court wishes to reconcile the two cases being Cook and Cushman, the Secretary would make two points on this issue. In the first instance, the Federal Circuit only addressed its own jurisdiction on Cushman. That is because it interpreted its own enabling statute and did not address the Board's or this Court's jurisdiction. The case that it relied on was In re Bailey. That was also not a veterans disability benefits case. That was an appeal from a disciplinary decision issued by this court. So the Federal Circuit in Cook was effectively addressing the issue of whether it had subject matter jurisdiction over that particular issue. Second, the Secretary would submit that Guillory and King held that the adjudication process effectively provides effective remedies to address such concerns through direct appeal or Q. These were available in this case to the appellant and the veteran, but she has not shown why, the appellant has not shown why she did not pursue such remedies, especially since the direct appeal was withdrawn. Therefore, the Secretary would submit that Cook precludes this court's jurisdiction over freestanding due process arguments, or that is, such arguments that are raised outside of the Q framework. In the alternative, if the court views Cushman as having precedential effect on this board and this court, which the Secretary does not concede here, that holding is limited to situations where the due process argument is made through the Q claim. That would distinguish this case from Cushman, where the claimant in that case did properly file the due process argument via Q claim. If the court disagrees with the Secretary and finds that it does have jurisdiction, then he would submit that there is no due process violation for three reasons. First, under Guillory and King, the appellant has not shown why the alleged error could not have been corrected through direct appeal, which was withdrawn, or through Q, which was never presented to the board, as the court noted in the October 2014 decision. Second, there was no adjudication between the two disputed VA medical opinions, the February 2005 opinion and the October 2005 addendum. In that sense, this case is also distinguished from Cushman, where the agency only saw the altered medical record and did not see the original. In this case, the agency had both records before it. And third, the Secretary would submit that the appellant's case was not prejudiced because there is no Q. Even if the October 2005 addendum is removed, if the court finds that the rating instructions were tainted, which again the Secretary does not concede, but if the court finds that they were tainted and the court finds that the addendum should be removed, the initial opinion is not demonstrative to show that there was Q or that the claim should have been granted at the outset, in light of the other contravening evidence of record that did not show the manifestation of paranoia until 15 years after.
Well, wait a minute. What about the morning reports?
Your Honor, it is unclear to the Secretary which report. It is unclear which reports appellant's counsel is referring to because they were not cited.
Well, have you seen them? I mean, do you dispute there are morning reports showing this some sort of mental condition in service? Or haven't you seen any morning reports?
Your Honor, may I have leave to speak with my
Sure.
Attorney. Your Honor, respectfully, it is unclear which records appellant's counsel is referring to, so we would be unable to answer that.
Well, when he gets back up, we'll ask him, I guess. You're serious? There's a dispute as to what the records he's referring to?
Your Honor, from the record, there is no indication to the Secretary that there was any manifestation of such symptoms, whether in morning reports or subsequent to that period. The board found this numerous times, and the record does not show that. If there are no further questions.
There are a few more questions, counsel. Let's talk a little bit about the due process argument. The appellant's counsel suggested that due process allegations have no time period, so that they can be raised at any time. What is your response to that?
Your Honor, we would disagree with that. The Federal Circuit in Cook, again, addressed the possibility of due process, explicitly addressed that possibility. This was admittedly a footnote in that decision, but we believe it is probative to the holding of that decision because the Federal Circuit was explaining that the argument advanced by the dissent was not so narrow that due process could not be considered.
Would you read that footnote, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, it begins, our dissenting colleague believes that an applicant for veterans benefits possesses a property interest of sufficient magnitude to invoke the protection of the Fifth Amendment's due process clause. Starting from that premise, we hold that where a breach of the duty to assist results in the denial of benefits, application of the rule of finality is tantamount to a denial of due process, and accordingly, the rule should be vitiated. Thus, Judge Kajarsa, would create a new exception to the rule of finality in order to obviate what he perceives to be a procedural due process violation arising from a breach of the duty to assist. The due process question was not briefed by the parties or argued to us. Nevertheless, assuming arguendo that a breach of the duty to assist may implicate the due process clause, we note that the claim adjudication process before the RO and the board has long provided a structure that affords a veteran a hearing. During the adjudication of his claim, a veteran may always assert that there has been a breach of the duty to assist. Moreover, as noted under the regime that has existed since 1988, if the Veterans Court determines that the VA failed to comply with the duty to assist, the court may vacate the decision being appealed and remand the case for further consideration in compliance with the duty to assist.
You're talking about footnote 9.
Yes.
The footnote goes on to say, however, and this to me is kind of an important point, if, however, a breach of the duty to assist is not known to the veteran during the adjudication of his claim and becomes known to the veteran only after the decision to deny his claim for benefits has become final, the veteran may only apply to have the final judgment reopened through two avenues provided by Congress, Q and new material evidence. Right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so, and it goes on to say, it's a nice footnote. Let me just go ahead and finish it up for you. These two avenues constitute significant departures from the normal rule that final judgments cannot be reopened. What is the significance of the knowledge element here? Did the appellant know about this breach or not?
Your Honor, the appellant had the opportunity to obtain those records, which would have provided the knowledge on direct appeal. But again, that appeal was withdrawn in order to pursue the Q issue.
For these reasons stated in this opinion, a breach of the duty to assist may not form the predicate for a Q claim. Whether it is possible for a veteran to ameliorate the potential harm of a breach of duty to assist with a claim of new material evidence is not a matter before us. In any event, the possibility that an error may occur during the claim adjudication process is not a reason to hold the process in violation of the due process clause and therefore vitiate the rule of finality. So, counsel, as I hear your position, it is really that there are only two, under Cook, even with the footnote, there are only two avenues.
Yes, Your Honor.
Here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Do you think we're free to disagree with that based upon Cook? Let me invite your attention, I hate to do this because it may be as a surprise, but Mathis versus McDonald, are you familiar with that case? 834 Fed 3rd, 1347. Apparently this morning the Supreme Court of the United States denied cert with two vigorous dissents, Sotomayor and Gorsuch. Completely different concept, but the rule remains the same. Are we free to disagree with Cook?
Your Honor, the court...
In the context of this case?
The court may be free to disagree, but we would submit that the court is bound by the holding of Cook.
Well, if I... Just, again, I'm not bringing this on you for any negative purpose. Full review would, I'm quoting from Justice Sotomayor, full review would require a petition arising from a case in which the VA denied a veteran's benefits after declining to provide the medical examiner's credentials. That's the separate issue there. Until such a petition presents itself, staying our hand allows the Federal Circuit and the VA to continue their dialogue over whether the current system for adjudicating veterans' disability claims can be squared, and this is the important part, with the VA's statutory obligations to assist veterans in the development of their disability claims. That's Justice Sotomayor in a statement. In the dissent to the denial of certiorari, Justice Gorsuch says, Now you might wonder if our intervention is needed to remedy the problem there. After all, a number of thoughtful colleagues on the Federal Circuit have begun to question the presumption's propriety. The presumption as having to do with the bona fides of the examiners. And this may well mean the presumption's days are numbered, but I would not wait in hope. The issue is of much significance to many today, and respectfully, it is worthy of this Court's attention. Well, what about us? Should we wait, or should we pay attention?
Your Honor, respectfully, we would submit that the Supreme Court is not as bound by stare decisis as other federal courts are, such as this one. In that sense, we would distinguish the two jurisdictions.
Understand. And if the stare decisis is the Holguin in Cook, that's your reference? Or is there something else?
No, Your Honor, Cook would be binding precedent.
Counsel, let me direct your attention to the record at 427 and 471. It's the same reference that I provided to appellant's counsel. This is the report by Dr. Green and the Appeals Management Center's direction that ended up, as far as I can tell, ended up resulting in a fairly different assessment than the initial favorable report to the veteran. Isn't there something fundamentally wrong there?
Your Honor, the Secretary does note that in the December 2011 court opinion that was characterized as argumentation, but we would point out that was a different claim stream, and looking at this these instructions, we believe that the rating specialist properly complied with his duties under 4.1, 4.12 to ensure that the veteran was provided with an adequate examination. The rating specialist pursuant to case law, are tasked with accumulating evidence, both positive and negative, provided that they do so in an impartial manner. And they can also do so as long as they do not suggest that a certain answer or a certain outcome is in order. Looking at the instructions, we do not believe that the rating specialist in this case was suggesting that a certain outcome was in order. The rating specialist was just identifying certain evidence that may be relevant in light of the fact that the examiner did not previously review the claims file, or did not indicate that she previously reviewed the claims file.
Okay. Could you read those instructions?
Your Honor, on page 450 of the record, it begins by stating, addressed to the examiner, please state in your report that you have reviewed the claims folder. If not, we run the risk of asking for a repeat examination and or addendum. On the next page, the opinion request goes on to state, the February 2005 mental examination of this veteran found it is as likely as not that his schizophrenia, paranoid, started in service per the history given. Please provide a rationale for this finding. The veteran's service history is limited due to the loss of records in the 1973 fire at the National Personnel Records Center, but available documentation does not manifest the type of service record common to personnel with this condition. He successfully completed 2 years of service, the full term of service for a draftee. His DD form 214, separation form, shows he was promoted. He had no lost time for being absent without leave or confinement, and he was awarded the Good Conduct Medal. Collectively, those facts indicate good discipline and service. Also, no bar to further service or reenlistment is annotated on the DD 214. Personnel with this condition in service are often identified wrongly as discipline problems until a mental condition is diagnosed. This fact is usually manifest by having frequent discipline problems resulting in grade or rank reductions, frequent AWOL, confinement, early administrative discharge, and bars to re-entry in the military annotated on the DD Form 214. His record reflects none of those things. The supporting rationale for concluding schizophrenia, paranoid, pre-existed, and or manifested in service must include studies, facts, treatment, and other evidence or information that shows a progression of this disability over time.
Okay, so after those instructions, the Dr. Green's assessment was significantly different, wasn't it, than the initial assessment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you amplify on the initial assessment and then the difference?
Yes, Your Honor. The initial assessment on page 471 of the record, Dr. Green found that it was as likely as not this disorder started in the service per the history given.
As likely as not.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the assessment after those instructions found in the record at 471?
449. 449, okay. The addendum opinion, Your Honor, read, after review of C-file, now feel it is impossible to say, without resorting to mere speculation, as to whether this veteran's schizophrenia, paranoid type, actually started in service without more documentation and records.
So had the C file not been reviewed initially?
Your Honor, it is unclear based on the examiner's notation.
But what is clear is that after the AMC request, that the report changed significantly, almost opposite of what the initial assessment was.
Yes, Your Honor, but we would submit that the rating specialist was trying to ensure that the exam was based on the correct factual predicate to make sure that the examiner had reviewed the veteran's claim file. That was unclear. In previous case law, this court has found that instructions that were based or where the examiner did not review the claims file were improper. And in this case, we would submit that the initial examination did not appear to be based on the review of the claims file, and the instructions were just seeking to ensure that the correct factual predicate was presented to the examiner.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Well, if I may, it sounds to me comparable to command influence, maybe even unlawful command influence. You familiar with that term?
Respectfully,
it's part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and a higher headquarters can't influence the outcome of a subordinate unlawfully. So I don't get too stuck on the analogy, but what is the AMC and what are the credentials of the so-called rating specialist to send a direction to a doctor, an MD, not pointing out the way I heard it and the way I read it, any particular medical issues? So who is this rating specialist? What are the rating specialist's credentials? Here I am referring to Mathis versus McDonald. Credentials are very much at issue there. So go ahead.
Your Honor, the rating specialists, as mentioned earlier, under the Secretary's regulations, are tasked with ensuring that...
No, but I'm talking about the credentials. What makes a rating specialist have the ability, other than the Secretary's decision to do so, question the medical opinion of a doctor?
Your Honor, we would submit that the rating specialist was not questioning the medical opinion, just the factual premise on which it was based.
Is the rating specialist a physician?
No, Your Honor.
What is it? Who was it? Is there a person behind this rating specialist?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you tell the court what the bona fides of the expertise of this rating specialist is?
Your Honor, may I believe?
Sure.
Your Honor, we would submit that the rating specialist's qualifications would not matter in this case because he's not an expert witness. He is trying to accumulate the evidence that would be relevant to the claim.
Well, what's the relationship structurally or intellectually, honestly, between Dr. Green? Is Dr. Green an employee of the VA?
I believe so, yes.
Right. And where is this rating specialist in the hierarchy of the whatever it is?
Your Honor, the rating specialist is in a distinct setup. He is not affiliated with the doctor.
The way I heard you read it out, it seemed to me the rating specialist was merely pointing out certain documents that the doctor might wish to consider. But it sounded more like mandatory to me, and maybe that's the reason why the doctor changed the opinion second time around. Shouldn't the board have considered that in making its determination? It seemed like a fairly compelling opinion the first time around, and then Dr. Green gets this message from higher up. You didn't do this, you didn't do that, you might want to consider this, you might, you know, what's the average person supposed to do with that?
And the board ultimately relied on that to deny benefits.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor, partially. The addendum was part of the decision. But again, if the addendum is removed, the remaining evidence would not, it is not outcome determinative based on what would be left in the
report. This all arises under the statutory duty to assist. Wouldn't you have expected the AMC to say, look, in order to help this veteran out, maybe you ought to make sure that you've checked this and you've checked that, and if there's a conflict between your opinion and this and that, resolve it. But instead, this sounded like a command, an influential command from a higher headquarters to a subordinate.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would, again, submit that the rating specialist was not suggesting that a different result was in order. But more significantly, this issue was, again, never presented to the board. And that theory of Q is not currently on appeal before the court in another sense anyways.
Let me ask, it seems maybe the timing might be interesting to discuss. The claimant had a board hearing on September the year 2004. And at which point the appellant's wife testified, as she did,
yes,
regarding her knowledge of his condition based on their relationship. So that was 2004. And then a year later, in October of 2005, the AMC requested a, quote, clarification of the examiner's opinion. First of all, is that a normal process, a procedure?
Your Honor,
to have the hearing, and then a year later or sometime thereafter say, well, you know, I think we might need a clarification on an opinion.
Your Honor, it is case dependent. It is not something that would be out of the ordinary.
And then once this opinion is received, returned to the AMC, well, first of all, when the AMC requests an clarification, is any notice given to the claimant or the claimant's representative that this is happening?
Your Honor, the claimant is provided notice through the decision that would be rendered. Whether it's
subsequently?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then when the opinion is received, it's just placed in the file, or is there a copy given to the claimant or the claimant's representative? Or is that
Your Honor, it is placed in the claims file, but the claimant can always request the copy if he so chooses.
But if the claimant didn't know that it was happening, that this had request had been made, he or she couldn't quite request something they didn't know was going on.
Yes, Your Honor, but they are always eligible to raise that on appeal.
And in this case, the appeal never occurred?
Your Honor, the appeal did occur, but it was withdrawn.
Okay. The appeal occurred, and then how long after that was the appeal withdrawn?
Your Honor, if I may check the record.
This was in May 2007, page 397 of the record. The appeal was noted as being withdrawn and dismissed.
And when was the decision made?
October 2006.
So between October 2006 and May 2007, the appellant would have had access to the board? File.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Any other questions? Counsel, I added 5 minutes to your time. You may conclude briefly.
Your Honors, respectfully, the Secretary just submits for the aforementioned reasons that the court should affirm the decision that there was no cue because the testimony was not outcome determinative. Even if the addendum opinion was removed, the remaining evidence did not show that the claim should have been granted at the outset. And again, the court does not have jurisdiction to hear the due process argument because it would require another exception to the rule of finality. But even if the court disagrees, the veteran and the appellant had numerous opportunities to redress their concerns, but they did not do so in this case, so there was no due process argument.
Thank you. Mr. Lesperance, I added 5 minutes to the Secretary's counsel. If you need that additional time, you may have it.
Thank you very much. Let me try to respond a little bit here. The appeal that was done in 2006-2007 was based on the record that was available in 2006. That did not include this directive from the AMC. The American Legion did not know about that. When the American Legion filed its brief, it was surprised that the competent examining doctor had changed her opinion and issued the little one she issued in October of 2005. The question from the American Legion was, where's the reasons and basis? That's what that little brief asked for. Where's the reasons and basis in this new comp and pen? But they never knew about the director from the AMC, and I didn't either. And that appeal was dismissed.
You said they didn't know about the directive.
Right.
Did they know about the revised opinion?
They did. And the brief was directed to why there were no reasons and basis in that revised opinion, but they didn't know why there was a revised opinion. I discovered the directive the next time we had an appeal, which was somewhere around 2010-2011. When that record was produced, it was there. And I saw it. And I brought it to the court's attention, and the court's aware of that from the order that was entered in 2011. And I didn't dismiss that substantive appeal in 2006 or 7, whenever it was, because it was a cue. There was no cue. And the reason I dismissed it was the general counsel and I agreed that this case made more sense as a cue than as a direct appeal. So I voluntarily dismissed that opinion.
But you said
appeal.
It was more apt for a cue rather than
a direct appeal. Right. And I don't even remember exactly how that issue
But you didn't
came
bring
up.
It up in the original cue.
No. Oh, I did, because I didn't know about it. I didn't know about the directive. I didn't know about it at that time. And the original Q that was filed, when I filed it with the board, back in probably 2007 or 8, that did not have this matter about the AMC, because I didn't find out about it until it appeared in a record. Remember, we didn't have EBMS back then. I couldn't do it.
The council, the secretary's counsel indicated that it would not have made a difference. It was not outcome determinative had it been removed. So what is the impact of that from your perspective?
Well, I certainly disagree with that, because clearly it was outcome determinative for the doctor. The doctor changed her opinion and issued a simple four-line opinion, changing what she had written 8 months before. And there's no reason why she would have done it unless there was a different outcome being directed.
But Mr. Yusoff indicated that the weight of the evidence would have gone in the other direction anyway.
Anyway. Right. I don't think there's any doubt that had the February comp and pen maintained as the final comp and pen exam, that we would have never had any litigation after that point. I think we'd have been done. Hmm. And the veteran would have still been alive, and it would have been better. Just a couple other things, if you want. I can't exactly find out where we first came up with the morning report information. I am sorry I didn't have it noted in my note of record. I didn't think it was going to come up.
But is it in the record, the morning report?
Yeah.
Is it in the record?
I don't know for sure. I don't know. I can give you where I think it is, but I don't 100% know for sure. I think it probably
Then how do you know about the morning report?
I'm the one that found it.
In the record?
Yeah.
Okay. You were going to cite us to something?
Yeah, I think it probably in the record at 1117 or 1160, but at this point I'm not 100% sure. I'm sorry. It wasn't briefed, and I didn't see that one coming. And I think it's interesting to note, I'm not sure the court needs to make its decision based on the constitutional issue. I still think that the board has not managed to comply with the court's directive. And I think the court's aware that there was a little time glitch between when we were here the last time and when this matter was presented to the board. But the court didn't have the benefit of the motions that were filed in 2013, the last time we were here. But they had already been filed, and they'd already been ruled on by the same judge that issued the 2012 opinion and the 2015 opinion. It's the same judge, and who made a specific ruling that's in the record that there wasn't enough of a constitutional violation for them to consider. So he certainly saw it. And saw the argument in 2013. The letter's in the file.
Did I hear you correctly to say that you don't think the court really needs to make a decision on the constitutional issue, but rather require the board to comply with the court's instructions?
That's exactly what
I think. And can you tell me what you perceive those court instructions to be?
I perceive the court's instructions to be to re-adjudicate the claim. And the decision that was before the court does not conform to the rigors of an adjudication. Taking all the facts known at the time and rendering an opinion with reasons and basis, considering the preponderance of the evidence and the benefit of the doubts, Gilbert versus Derwinski. And the board still hasn't done what Chief Judge Davis asked them to do on two occasions.
So why are we fooling around with this? Why don't we just enter an order? You really, is that all you're asking for, is sending it back to them to cross the T's and dot the I's?
Not
they
really, because
they lose two or three chances to get it right?
I don't think they'll do it. That's why we're doing
it. She could die by then.
Yeah, we could all, yeah. We already had one person.
That's
so
right.
Yeah, we could do
it. I'm being serious. Is that all you're asking for, or let me put it another way, is that all you think we have the power to do?
Oh, no. I think you have the power to tell the board exactly what they should do.
Do you want them to go to back to square one and rejudicate the entire case again? Is that what you're looking for?
No, not now. I'm just saying you could, because they didn't do their job. But that's not what I'm looking for, because I think now that the veteran has died in early 2012, there's no way that he can be reexamined. Under Cushman, that's your remedy. Your remedy is to send him back and have another comp and pen exam. Well, I can't do that. What I'd like to do is have this decision based on the rating, the comp and pen exam that was available in February of 2005, and or have the court order that the board be overturned because they violated his constitutional rights and litigated against him, and have the remedy be that he be awarded benefits. Either one of those would be great for the widow.
Ordered benefits and the amount, what about the effective date?
Claim was filed in 2002.
Is that what you claim to be the effective date they should have applied?
I do.
All right. And you say you can get there apart from the constitutional issue based upon the facts that I summarized earlier. Is that correct?
Yes.
Still stand by that?
Yes.
All right.
But you want the board to relook it over on the basis of Q?
Do I want the board?
You want the court to instruct the board to re-adjudicate the case?
It would not be my preference. I would rather have the court make some kind of final determination, because this widow is not getting any younger.
Well,
We're talking about
for us to make the decision.
To the extent that you feel that you can, yes, I do.
Counsel, you heard the discussion between the bench and Mr. Yusof regarding footnote number 9 in Cook.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any comments on footnote number 9 in Cook and its impact on your analysis?
I agree with the court. I think the footnote is very instructive, and I just don't think it's a finality question. I think it's a jurisdictional question, and that it's not really a problem in this case.
Because
you have a constitutional issue. It's not something that needs to have that kind of finality that you had in Cook.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.
Yeah, more fun to come.
It was a pleasure.
Safe travels.